proceed to the second case, Busan Sokolic versus the Milwaukee. Ms. Bragg?
May it please the Court, my name is Chomi Prague, and I represent the appellants Dustin Busan Sokolic and Chomi Prague. This is an appeal from judgment on adversary in the bankruptcy court. The main issue is whether a loan from a school that is owed no costs and is refunded to a parent rather than a student is dischargeable to the student debtor under 11 U.S.C. 523A8. I would like to discuss three main points with the Court today. The first would be how a school's loan that fails to cover any costs and a school's failure to have any order tracing how aid is applied to expenses but refunding a parent rather than a student is dischargeable under the bankruptcy code. The second issue would be how MSOE was not collecting on amounts not paid when due under their note in the bankruptcy court. And the third would be that frivolous merits make for a frivolous appeal and ours aren't. At the time that the student signed the loan with MSOE, he owed no cost to the school. Therefore, the loan served no educational purpose. MSOE would like to be able to claim that they did apply aid to expenses in a way that would show that the Parents PLUS loan resulted in the refund, which was returned to the parent. But the testimony of MSOE at the bankruptcy court level doesn't state such, and the actual student account printout that was filed as an exhibit in the bankruptcy court also doesn't show such. The first semester of the exhibit, it's actually 1-24, and it's exhibit 9. If you look at the actual semesters, there's three semesters that are involved, and the first semester, $1,000 of the MSOE loan was returned to the mother. And the second and the third semesters, either you can look at the way that aid was applied to expenses in terms of a list, or you can look at it in terms of the way that aid was applied to expenses in the terms of dates. And MSOE used the argument that what they did was they took all aid and put it in a bucket, and all of the expenses that the student owed was put in a bucket. And then what they did was they applied the aid. The aid consisted of scholarship money that the student received, grant money, the MSOE loan, the student's own federal loan, as well as the Mother's Plus loan. So all of the aid was in a bucket, and the expenses that the student had was in a bucket. And what they did was they applied aid to expenses. But then that MSOE was able to arrive to the conclusion that the mother was owed a refund based on her PLUS loan. And the first semester, according to their student account printout, that definitely isn't what happened. And the second and third semesters, one can't tell exactly where refunds came from. Therefore,
are you challenging the factual findings of the bankruptcy court?
To a certain extent, yes.
Let me ask you a different question. That's an uphill battle. What do you think the test should be for deciding whether a loan is an educational loan subject to the non-dischargeability provisions?
The cases, the relevant cases in this kind of situation, use the analysis that it's the purpose and the benefit that's important. And the purpose goes...
Whose purpose?
The purpose of the loan.
Whose purpose?
For the student.
So it's the student's subjective purpose that makes a difference?
No. It's the actual purpose of the loan and whether or not that helped the student to obtain an education.
Does its use make a difference?
the use of the loan does not make a difference in terms of the law, but what does make a difference is whether or not the student was able to use and spend loan proceeds. And in our case, the student was not.
So under your approach, if it turns out that there's more available money, a combination of loans and scholarships, than the student actually needs, that to replace, in essence, one loan with another doesn't allow the second loan to be an educational loan when it was used to replace an educational loan?
I don't know if I really understand.
Let me try that again.
Okay, please.
The Mother's Plus loan, was that an educational loan?
It was necessary in order for the student to obtain an education.
Okay. But it turned out there was more money available, and so it was possible to refund that and replace it with the student's own loan, right?
Well, the student's loan to the school was signed last.
Exactly.
Right.
So that money wound up being refunded, used to refund the Mother's Plus loan in part, correct?
Well, I don't know if we can say that.
That's what the bankruptcy court found, correct?
That could be correct.
Let's go with me on that.
Okay.
Okay? So it's used, in essence, to refinance an earlier loan from a few months earlier.
That the MSOE loan was used?
Yes.
To refinance?
Yes.
The Mother's Plus loan?
Right. Isn't that what happened? Isn't that what the bankruptcy court found happened?
That the MSOE loan was used to refund the mother.
In part.
In part.
Right?
That is.
Why isn't that an educational loan?
Well, because the student didn't receive the benefit of the loan. The mother received the refunds.
That's like saying my original mortgage company got all the benefit from my refinancing when I took out another loan, right? They're still mortgage loans. And they're still for my benefit, right?
True, but in this situation, I think with your hypothetical, if somebody else possibly would have been involved in mortgaging your property, we'd have a little bit more of a problem. Maybe I'm not understanding completely.
Go ahead.
According to the cases, it appears that if the student doesn't receive the benefit and the student doesn't receive the refunds to spend on anything that they want, then the loan appears to be dischargeable. In our situation, I haven't found any cases that necessarily state that if a loan is used to refinance somebody else's loan, that that's an exception to discharge. All we can tell from the student account printout is that there were three distinct semesters, and that according to the first semester, the MSOE loan was applied last by the school, and a refund that included $1,000 of the MSOE loan was refunded to the mother. Now, under the Code of Federal Regulations, it's 34 CFR 668.164E, if Title IV funds create a credit balance, then the funds have to be refunded either to the student or to the parent borrower. And we cannot see from the record how it is that MSOE was able to arrive at the conclusion that Title IV funds created a credit balance at all, and that the MSOE loan or that the grant money or scholarship could have created the credit balance.
Ms. Prague, let me ask you. This started out as a $3,000 loan and a $5,900 judgment in state court.
Okay.
It's now up to $80,000 plus.
Right.
With sanctions and so on, which I'd frankly like to hear from you about. And one thing that would be helpful for me to know would be, what was your best effort to bring to the bankruptcy court's attention the merger doctrine issue, the problem about whether the school could recover attorney's fees after it had already gotten a judgment that included attorney's fees in state court? What was your best effort to bring that to the bankruptcy court's attention?
Well, the bankruptcy court, in its amended motion or its order on the amended motion to reconsider, did address that the MSOE loan, the note, contained a provision which obligated the appellant to pay for any collection costs for the unpaid loan balance. And
were challenging all along the right to get further attorney's fees, correct? Or is that incorrect?
We did take issue with that, Your Honor, yes.
Mm-hmm. When did you bring the merger issue, the merger doctrine issue, to the attention of the bankruptcy court? What's the closest you came to doing that?
By bringing up the American rule, because what we did was we did make the argument in our amended motion to reconsider that there was no statutory right to attorney's fees in the adversary. We focused on the statutory right and there not being a statutory right under the bankruptcy code to allow attorney's fees to the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And the bankruptcy court did state in its order on the amended motion to reconsider that the note contained a provision which obligated the appellant to pay for the collection costs for the unpaid loan balance. And our statement of issues on appeal to the district court asked whether the award of MSOE's attorney's fees in the adversary based on the terms of a promissory note was reversible error. So we did discuss the American rule at the bankruptcy court level. In terms of the merits of our appeal, we think that the argument can be made, the arguments that we made. Now, there's nothing in the record regarding the merits of our appeal. And in terms of what makes an appeal frivolous, the courts look at whether issues were properly addressed, whether the issues were supported on appeal, whether a person cites inapplicable authority and makes unsubstantiated factual assertions or draws bare legal conclusions or misrepresents the record. We did none of these things. Our argument has been the whole time that the MSOE loan, at the time that it was signed by the student, it was not needed at all. It did not cover any direct costs at the school, and also the student did not get to put any of that money in his pocket to use for anything whatsoever. The educational purpose analysis goes to whether or not the loan helps the student to obtain an education, not whether or not it goes to help a parent refinance their loan or anything like that. If there are no other questions, I'd like to save time for rebuttal.
Is it correct that the issue of sanctions was one that you first raised by seeking sanctions against MSOE?
In terms of the Rule 9011?
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
Without having gone through the required warning shot process?
That's true. I did not follow the safe harbor rule. That's correct, Your Honor.
That's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, I don't think that the actual merits of the 9011 were necessarily frivolous. I think that when a person takes a stand and...
Don't try to defend that.
Okay.
Counsel, there was criticism that you filed your appeal in this court even though there hadn't been a final order or judgment and motions were pending. Is that true?
That is true. The district court did take issue with that.
Okay. Do you want to explain why you proceeded in that fashion?
With filing the notice of appeal at that point in time, because I thought I did not want to miss the time frame to file the appeal. I did not want to lose the right to file the appeal because at that point, the district court did state that he was affirming the bankruptcy court and that the bankruptcy court would be affirmed and waited some time after that to file the first notice of appeal. And the reason why was because there was nothing handed down in writing within the 30-day time frame that the district court stated that he was affirming the bankruptcy court. So we got the transcript, and the transcript stated that the district court was affirming the bankruptcy court, so we did not want to lose the right to appeal, which is why we took appeal at that time. Thank you.
Ms. McTighe?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christine McTighe, and I represent the Milwaukee School of Engineering. I do not want to stand here and rehash what's in my brief. I would just like to make a few points in response to what was raised in the appellant's argument, and, of course, if there are any questions, to try to answer them.
Well, perhaps you could help me on this difference between the roughly 62,000 and the 80. How do we find the 18 in the record?
The court refers to document 71. That was the fee petition and letter submitted by the Case law firm, which represented MSOE in the court below. It has a nice breakdown on the third page, starting from the original student loan amount with the attorney's fees, the interest, the further attorney's fees, the Case law firm attorney's fees, getting up to the $80,000. It sets out each individual amount in there.
You think that's evident from the transcript? I mean, as far as the judge arriving at that figure.
Are we talking about Judge Klobert in ordering the 60,000 sanctions, or are we talking about the bankruptcy court award of fees?
Bankruptcy court award of fees.
The Case law firm submitted a fee petition, in essence its billing statement, to the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court used that exact number to award the fees. And it was, I'm looking here on the sheet.
And as to Chief Judge Klobert, we find that he adopts that? Is that?
Chief Judge Klobert did was then in the district court level, the Case law firm submitted its fees incurred in the district court, but also attached this sheet which showed the chronology of everything that had been assessed up to that date, including the bankruptcy court's award of $16,000. So it's all laid out here, and it is based, if you go back, I know it's not in the record in this case, but if you went to PACER and looked in the adversary docket, you will see the fee petition submitted there.
Do that? I mean, I you know, we're paid to do a lot, but is that the way the record ought to come to us from the district court?
There was never any dispute that what the Case law firm submitted in the district court, which showed what the bankruptcy court had awarded, was in any way incorrect. The counsel for the appellant never at any stage of the proceedings, whether in the bankruptcy court or in the district court, contested the amount of fees. There was never an issue about that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There was some discussion here about the merger doctrine and the fees awarded by the bankruptcy court. This court, in the Mayer case, has recognized that in a dischargeability proceeding, the creditor can obtain its fees.
Is that a question of state law or federal law?
It is actually a question of federal law because it involves the interpretation of 523C.
Well, let me. The other party cited a Third Circuit case that treats it as a state law issue, the A&P Diversified Technologies mm-hmm. case. Is that wrong? I mean, obviously we're dealing with interaction between federal
right.
bankruptcy law and state law, but in terms of the effect of the state court judgment that was obtained earlier,
mm-hmm.
is that a question of federal law or state law?
In terms of whether, for example, the language in the note authorizes the award mm-hmm. of fees, that's state law.
Okay.
And that is allowed under Wisconsin law.
Can you talk about the Production Credit Association and Waukesha Concrete cases, which seem to suggest that the merger mm-hmm. doctrine is pretty healthy in Wisconsin?
We have never contested the merger doctrine. We have never said the merger doctrine is not applicable. The merger doctrine is what I like to think of as a more fancy name for saying you can't split your cause of action. For example, once you have filed suit on a note and you've been awarded your fees or your interest or whatever, you can't, once that judgment has been obtained, you can't then go back in the collection proceedings and say, well, now I want more interest on my note. Wisconsin has said no, you cannot do that under the merger doctrine. However, the merger doctrine arises out of the restatement, and the restatement, as we've cited in our brief, does recognize an exception, which basically says when you obtained your original judgment, if you did not have the opportunity for whatever reason, whether it's jurisdiction, whether it's because of timing, to collect more on that judgment, you're not barred by merger. So our argument is that when we sued the debtor in state court in Racine County, we obtained our fees, came up to a little over $5,000. Then the debtor filed his adversary against us in the bankruptcy court, and we asked for our fees. Well, we couldn't have asked for our fees that we incurred in the bankruptcy court in the prior litigation in Racine County, because how would we have known?
But you're relying upon the contract, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So the question is whether the state contract continues to let you collect fees after you've gotten a final judgment enforcing that contract.
And our argument is yes, because in our case, there is an exception to the merger doctrine, so you still would be able to obtain the rights under the contract. I could not find a case directly on point in Wisconsin interpreting this section of the restatement. I did find a case which recognizes another exception to the merger doctrine, which indicates that Wisconsin is open to exceptions to the merger.
Doesn't that suggest that the whole issue is at least fairly debatable then, and not necessarily sanctionable?
Well, the bankruptcy court did not award the fees as a sanction.
No, it did not. I understand that.
Okay.
But that's only one quarter of the judgment here.
Correct. And so without,
and it's the other three quarters that are the sanctions, as I understand it, at least in part, for having argued about whether the fees were properly awarded in the bankruptcy court.
That is correct, Your Honor. That was one of the reasons Judge Clivert gave. However, he said in his order, apart from the specific instances of finding the appeal as litigated as frivolous, he specifically said he found all the fees incurred by the school were the result of a meritless appeal. And he affirmed the bankruptcy court, and I think his ruling indicates that he found the whole proceeding, not just the small part about merger, to have been frivolous under Rule 8020. He makes two specific statements. He says, you know, I find the appeal as litigated was frivolous, and then he also said, I find that all the fees were incurred as a result of a meritless appeal. When I was writing this brief, and then when I started to prepare for oral arguments, sometimes things hit you when you're not writing the brief, and I went back and read the testimony, and I think what we have a situation here is we have a student and a mother who for some reason took out too much money. Now, I don't know what their reasons were, but they were. And under the federal regulations, she was refunded the appropriate money. What else was the school to do? The school can't keep the money. And once you borrow the money, just because you get a refund, you still have to repay your loan. I see this as mixing apples and oranges and not having one to do with the other, because I don't think there's any question when you read Steve Midthun's testimony, the whole program that the school has set out for administering financial aid and that these loans that the debtor took out were part of this program governed by the school. We have a promissory note. This isn't a situation with an open account. We have a note. The note was signed. The money was dispersed. And under this court's decision in the Chambers case, that's a loan.
What do you think the test should be for whether it's an educational loan?
I think the test should be to look, and Chambers talks about this, to look at there are three elements. Is under 523. Is it an educational loan made part of a program by a nonprofit institution? And I think you look to as far as what the educational loan is.
That's the element that's in dispute.
Why was that loan taken out? In other words, was it part of that program administered by either the school or the federal government? Because there's no question you can take out a student loan and go buy a car.
Do we focus on the lender's purpose then?
You focus on the purpose. You do not focus on what the money was actually used for.
Do we focus on whether it was necessary or just convenient?
I don't know if it's even necessary or convenient, but really it's whether it's related.
Mm-hmm.
So the Barth case makes clear, if you let people take this money out in a program and go by a car, or as one of my classmates once did, went and bought a Walkman, you can't get off the hook. You can't use this as an excuse under Section 523.
In applications for these types of loans, is there any representation made as to use when you're applying for the loan?
I know in this case, in our loan we're talking about, no, there wasn't. I'm not too familiar with the PLUS or the Stafford loans to know.
Do you think it's reasonable or correct to think about this case in terms of, in essence, a kind of refinancing? That is where the, in essence, where the later loan was used in part to refund part of the earlier loan, the PLUS loan.
I think that's a good analogy.
And at least, I don't know, my experience is that schools tend to think about families as units when they put together financial aid packages.
I would agree. And that's why you have the situation here where the mother went out and took the one, student went and took out the others. You know, that happens, as Your Honor says, that happens quite a bit. I remember in my days my parents would take out some loans and then I would take out some loans. But, yes, it's a package. So, and I think you have to look at the whole package. So, one other point I want to make about this printout. I understand I don't find it the easiest document in the world to follow, but if you look at it, the MSOE loan for $1,000 per term was applied. The refund of the PLUS loan is indicated as a separate amount of a little over $2,000 per term to the mother. I have nothing further unless there are any further questions.
Apparently not. Thank you.
In the Chambers case, that case dealt with lines of credit and a line of credit that was given to a student. Our case has nothing to do with line of credit. There was no credit given to the student. The student had already obtained more than enough in terms of funds before he signed the MSOE loan. There was no educational purpose to the loan. He also received no refunds from the MSOE loan. He received no refunds whatsoever. Therefore, there was no educational benefit that the student received either from signing the MSOE loan. And the refinancing or the idea that the MSOE loan may have refinanced the mother's PLUS loan, that type of analysis hasn't been drawn in any case thus far. And the student did not sign that MSOE loan to help refinance his mother's loan. That was not his intent. He signed
that. What was his intent in getting that loan?
He thought he needed the money to go to school there. He thought he had not obtained enough in funds to go to school there, or at least, at the very least, he'd be getting money back to spend. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.